From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. That's apparently the news for voters in the UK. RT's Colin Bray has more.
The majority of votes have been counted in the UK's general election, with David Cameron now certain to remain in number 10. And one of the first things he did was reaffirm his plans to hold a referendum on Britain leaving the EU. Let's discuss the results that have been coming in the past few hours with RT's Laura Smith, who's in London. Laura, it's been quite a night. Nobody predicted this to happen, did they? Another 5 years of David Cameron as Prime Minister.
They certainly didn't, and I think it's for that reason that David Cameron said that this victory had been particularly sweet for him. All the polls said that it was far too close to call, that there would be no majority for any party, and that there would be all this horse trading, a hung parliament. In fact, none of that has happened. David Cameron has basically swept to power, increasing his majority from a coalition government, which is pretty exceptional, actually. And then what we're seeing here today on Friday is this sea change in the political landscape. Scotland has been turned almost all yellow. The Scottish National Party has won almost all of Scotland and will now be representing Scotland in Westminster, ousting a number of major Labour figures along the way. And now the leaders of all the main opposition parties have stepped down. They fell like dominoes around about midday today. Nigel Farage notably stepped down in a flurry of criticism of the first-past-the-post voting system, saying that his party had won 4 million votes, which is more than the SNP did in Scotland, but taken only one seat.
What about further afield, though? We heard at the top of the hour, David Cameron again. He's not going to let this referendum go, if anybody had any doubts about it, on Britain choosing whether to stay with Brussels or not.
That's right, and it's certainly uppermost in his mind. And you showed a clip of him there standing on the steps of 10 Downing Street, reaffirming his commitment to it, saying we will deliver this in-out referendum on Europe. And in fact, his backbenchers are already angling for it. And it certainly seems that he has ridden into Downing Street again on a wave of Euroscepticism, winning back some of those votes that everyone thought would be taken by the UK Independence Party. Of course, Euroscepticism is their main policy. So therefore, to represent voters, he may feel that he has to carry on being a thorn in the side of Brussels. And there have been several examples of that during his premiership. He put Angela Merkel's back up with talk of controlling immigration into Britain from the European Union. For her, of course, this free movement of people around the EU is a key tenet of what the European Union actually means. She even said that she would rather see the UK leave than compromise on that. And of course, he has also annoyed the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker by quibbling over this £1.7 billion bill that was presented to the UK last year, among other things. So they and other EU leaders will be anti a referendum here in the UK. Of course, there's no notable UKIP presence in Parliament to hold him to that promise. So only he and his own backbenchers will be pushing for it. So we'll have to see how strong Cameron's resolve actually is.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot to watch in the coming days, isn't there, to be honest? And no doubt a few cautious congratulatory phone calls to David Cameron's office in the coming hours. Laura Smith in London, thanks very much for that update. Now, this general election has seen all three main opposition party leaders resign, including Labour's Ed Miliband. Earlier today, he admitted that it's been a difficult night for his party, saying a lot of ground was lost in Scotland.
This has clearly been a very disappointing and difficult night for the Labour Party. We haven't made the gains we wanted in England and Wales, and in Scotland, we've seen a surge of nationalism overwhelm our party.
Well, the Scottish National Party caused a political earthquake, almost totally wiping out any opposition in Scotland. In the election 5 years ago, it only had 6 seats. Well, now it's got 56 out of a total of 59 in Scotland. The party's been on the rise since last year's Scottish independence referendum. Back then, the Conservative government's last-minute promises won over voters in Scotland, who did decide against breaking away from the UK. But few of those promises have been delivered yet, pushing many Scots towards the Nationalists, mainly at the expense of Labour. Well, John White is a Scottish political commentator. He believes Labour's biggest mistake was in its shift to the right.
The problem in Scotland vis-a-vis Labour wasn't that the party wasn't seen as being Scottish enough, but not Labour enough. And I do feel now that we are looking at a second referendum on Scottish independence, it's inarguable that in response to the economic crisis of 2008, people in Scotland have shifted to the left, while people in England have shifted to the right under the Tories. They have endorsed and embraced a pro-austerity message, while in Scotland, a anti-austerity message has been embraced.
UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon is travelling to a number of celebrations marking the end of World War II in Europe, and on Friday, he was in Kiev.
Your Excellency, President Petro Poroshenko of Ukraine, dear citizens of Ukraine, ladies and gentlemen, Dobry Ranok. It's a great honor for me to be here standing together with President Poroshenko and his people of Ukraine in this very solemn and sacred place where we are honoring and commemorating the many valiant and courageous Ukrainian soldiers and citizens who fought to defend their country, to defend their human dignity against the aggression of Nazism.
But Mark Sloboda, professor of international relations at Moscow State University, called the Secretary General's anniversary statement in support of the government in Kiev ironic.
The irony, and I would say the sickness, the perversity of Ban Ki-moon's statements in Kiev is that he is honoring the putsch president, Poroshenko, and the regime that are the open ideological and political heirs of the Ukrainian insurgent army in World War II. They have declared the Ukrainian insurgent army, the UPA, to be their national heroes. And one of its most prominent leaders, Stefan Bandera, to be essentially the founding father of the new Ukraine. And this UPA, almost entirely from Western Ukraine, Stefan Bandera, they openly collaborated with the Nazi regime, with the Third Reich, before the war when they were training with them. During the war, they committed atrocities hand-in-hand with the Germans at Baba Yar and elsewhere in Ukraine against Jews, Poles, and also, most relevantly today, against Ukrainians, particularly those from East Ukraine. They participated in mass bloody atrocities of other Ukrainians, which is why there can never be a unified Ukraine with a government that worships these people. This is an obscene cult of fascist worship. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and Poles were killed by these people. It is completely whitewashed with the apologia that is coming out of Western governments and media today. It is a perverse rewriting of history, a history of World War II that most Westerners know nothing about. And now it's being written so that they will never know anything about it. There were entire divisions formed of UPA members, Roland and Nachtigall, entire battalions, I'm sorry, and there was also the Galician Division that fought with the Waffen SS, right? And the government that is in power in Kiev today has proclaimed these people to be national heroes and has given them full veterans benefits and rights. So let's put that in a little context, because Western governments are supporting this regime. They are supporting, they are paying tens of billions of dollars to support it, to facilitate its military subjugation of the rest of the country, and in effect, to pay the veterans' benefits of Waffen SS of Ukrainian origin. And the American people, first of all, they should be ashamed, because this is their democratic government that is doing this. All right, and we can talk about how democratic the U.S. government actually is, but Americans aren't out in the street protesting about it. Americans don't even care. But the people of Russia and the people of East Ukraine do care.
China's President Xi Jinping arrived in Russia Friday, beginning his 3-day visit, during which he'll attend a parade commemorating the 70th anniversary of the victory over the Nazi Germany. Soon after landing in Moscow, Xi met with his Russian counterpart, President Vladimir Putin. The two are reportedly discussing some 40 joint agreements, ranging from crude oil trade cooperation, natural gas projects, railway cooperation, finance, and cybersecurity among them. CCTV's Clint DeLoach has more.
At a welcoming ceremony at the airport, Xi Jinping said China and Russia will hold a series of commemorative events this year to show their joint resolve in maintaining the outcome of World War II, as well as international fairness and justice. Xi Jinping held China's friendship with Russia, saying the two countries have become a paragon of peaceful coexistence and mutually beneficial cooperation. The Chinese president then held talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in the Kremlin. The two leaders vowed to safeguard peace and discuss bilateral ties and international issues of mutual concern. A joint statement on strengthening the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination is expected to be signed.
The ceasefire in Yemen, announced on Thursday by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Saudi counterpart, has apparently not yet begun. Saudi-led forces warned civilians in Yemen that the Sa'ada province would be a military target as of Friday evening. That according to Saudi state television Al-Akhbariya. The Saudis warned all civilians to leave the province, a stronghold of Yemeni forces, by 7 p.m. local time Friday. Saudi Arabia said Thursday it would respond to cross-border attacks that started Tuesday. The Saudis have targeted the province with airstrikes since then. A Pakistan military helicopter carrying foreign diplomats crashed Friday. Later reports said that the dead included the Norwegian and Philippine ambassadors and the wives of the Malaysian and Indonesian ambassadors. Ambassadors from South Africa, Lebanon, and Romania were also reported to be on board, but were reported to be uninjured. The diplomats were heading to the launch of projects in a mountainous region in northern Pakistan. And now we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua, on news and events taking place in the Latin American and Caribbean region.
As usual, there's an awful lot going on. President Raul Castro of Cuba
in Moscow.
Visiting
That's right.
Moscow for the
celebration,
the anniversary of the end of the Second World War.
And the victory over fascism, at least the military victory over German fascism.
Raul Castro has been there for 2 or 3 days holding quite extensive talks with other members of President Putin's government.
You know, he's probably lived a pretty good life. Have you ever been to Moscow? I don't know. Have you ever been to Moscow?
No, I've never been. I've never had the good fortune to go to Moscow.
In Moscow, in the old downtown, I was there once, and it was in 1990. But down where the one of the Seven Sisters, the big ministry buildings that were constructed in town, is located, there's an artist section. It's like a walkway and a park area called the Arbat. And on the Arbat, there's a restaurant, like, it's in the second floor of this little strip mall, basically. It was still there, but it was called the Praga, Prague restaurant. And that is like the coolest hang I have ever been at. And, you know, Raul and Fidel made a number of trips to Moscow over the last half century, I'm sure. And that's one of the things that they got to enjoy, I hope, you know, just hanging out in Moscow, because it is a really cool hang.
Yeah, I should imagine that the people in the Cuban government have many friendships in Moscow, I was interested to see that the Cuban media were very gave a lot of prominence to the death of the a leading ballerina from Moscow. So and although the focus always when one talks about the Russian Federation or the former Soviet Union and Cuba is always political, but there's an awful lot of cultural stuff as well,
huge.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been to the Bolshoi, for example, and they made me do that while I was there, and I was like, oh, man, I'm so glad you people made me do this tonight. I would never think of doing that, and I live by New York.
Right. So then there's that, and another visit of some importance in the region over the next few days will be the visit of the French president, François Hollande. He's doing a visit to the French territories in the Caribbean, Guadeloupe, Martinique, a couple of small islands, San Bartolome, and I forget the other one. But he's also going to pay a visit to Cuba.
Oh, good.
And so, and that's that in supposedly this visit by François Hollande, the French president to the Caribbean, is part of the preparation for the big climate change summit in Paris that's scheduled for much later in the year. So let's see what happens around that. I'm sure it's also around the future relations of the European Union with Cuba, given the apparent opening of relations between Cuba and the United States government.
You know, I wonder how the domestic politics for somebody like Hollande, you know, who's nominally a socialist and who, you know, gets elected by the apparatus of an actual socialist party, relates to Cuba both before at the insistence of the United States, you know, hands off, and then, you know, now when it's, you know, it's kosher to go to Havana, and, you know, does he do it or not? I wonder what his domestic political considerations are on that question.
To be honest, I haven't got a clue, because I know next to nothing about internal French politics, except that because I'm from Ireland and I keep an eye on the way trends are going in Europe. I mean, there's generally a right wing trend in Europe, and a greater polarization. I don't know if it's true to say that there's increasing polarization in the United States and Canada. I should imagine there was, but that's certainly the case in Europe. For example, you got this victory in the United Kingdom elections by David Cameron's right-wing Conservative Party, and against what was essentially a centre-right Labour Party.
Right.
And François Hollande's party in France is pretty much a centre-right party now, because the agenda over the last 25 years in Europe has shifted so much to the right that anything that's even remotely progressive is regarded as extremely radical. And you can see that in the way, in the reaction of the mainstream political leaders and mainstream corporate media to the crisis in Greece, can't you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, not only that. Well, first, just to digress for a second, to go to the first thing you mentioned, here in the United States, it's extremely polarized. The polarization, though, takes place between partisans of the Democrats and the Republicans, and largely over social issues. Largely over same-sex marriage or over abortion rights or that. Nothing that has to do with human, you know, political rights or freedom of speech and all these things. There's no, there's rhetorical distinctions between the two groups, but there's no policy distinction whatsoever. And that's reflected in the policy made on a bipartisan level in the government. The polarization that exists in interest, like between the working class and this apparatus, for example, is not organized nearly enough to be up to the task of being a viable political force. And that's kind of the situation in Europe, except now you're seeing Syriza and Podemos and that kind of response coming in an organized political way, and even taking the government in Greece so far.
Right. Yeah, and who knows how things are going to go in Europe. I'm very pessimistic about the short-term political outlook in Europe. And in the same way that I'm quite optimistic about the short- and medium-term outlook here in Latin America. And one of the things that's going to be a very, very important kind of sign of whether the moves towards regional integration are able to consolidate themselves in a positive, progressive way here in Latin America and the Caribbean. Is the current case going on in the International Court of Justice in The Hague in Holland,
yeah,
between Chile and Bolivia about their long-standing, over a century-old dispute about Bolivia's right to access to the sea? And that, of course, stems from this long-forgotten war in 1879, or long-forgotten by most people, not forgotten by people in Bolivia, certainly, in which Chile and Peru defeated Bolivia, and Chile took over something like 22,000, something over 20,000 square kilometers of Bolivian territory, cutting off Bolivia from its access to the sea. And so that case is what Bolivia is arguing in its presentation to the International Court of Justice, is that for over a century, since an agreement in 1904, Chile has promised that Bolivia, that it will consider how to reinstate Bolivia's access to the sea. That's fundamentally what I understand to be the Bolivian government's argument. Right. And the Chilean government argues that that's not the case at all, and they at the moment, what they're essentially discussing is whether the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, has jurisdiction in the case at all. And so, and it'll be interesting to see how that pans out, but it's quite depressing in a way that,
yeah,
again, you have this phenomenon of a supposedly socialist government, Michelle Bachelet's government in Chile, that's adopting really quite retrograde positions in vis-a-vis the overall development of the region in terms of its integration. It's quite surprising to see how retrograde and reactionary Michelle Bachelet's position, and the position of almost all leading Chilean politicians, are in relation to this claim by Bolivia.
Well, there's the realities, of course, on the ground in Chile. Bachelet does not have, a majority of socialists in the legislature, right? And there's all kinds of brokering that goes on, and
yeah,
this is a fine point of nationalist pride, of national pride or whatever, among a broad sector of the voting population. And so she could become completely, out of the pale to the electorate, yeah, by,
Yeah, and there is that, but it's also very clear that the area in question is basically desert.
Right.
You're not talking about wealthy farmland or anything, And the area in question that's in dispute is basically a desert.
Right.
So, yeah.
There are constructs,
right.
Just to interrupt for a second. There are constructs that can be developed in terms of negotiations where, for example, for Bolivia, the primary thing is the actual access to the sea. And they could play with the title and the sovereignty issues in contracts, in treaties.
Yeah.
We're giving it to, we're ceding it back to Bolivia. However, we retain the right of development in this area or whatever. And, that there's room to play if the purpose is not an outright denial. And just the last thing is, the thing that really is disappointing to me is the fact that this has to be decided at The Hague in the first place instead of in Latin America.
Oh, yeah. I'm very much so. And I know a lot of commentators in Latin America make that very point that you just made. It's so counterproductive, isn't it, to end up having to go to a foreign tribunal to, even though it is the United Nations, essentially the world court. Yeah. And it's hard to know, in relation to the point that you made about Michelle Bachelet not having a majority in the legislature in Chile, it's hard to know how seriously to take that, because currently she's under a lot of pressure. The other day she asked all her cabinet ministers to hand in their resignations because she wanted to restructure her cabinet. And that came about largely as a result of two or three corruption scandals that have really put her personally on the spot, because there are two or three different scandals involving people across the political spectrum in Chile, some to do with influence trafficking, with Chile's financial sector, a big firm in a big company in Chile's financial sector, some to do with electoral shenanigans about campaign financing. But the one that's most damaging for Michelle Bachelet is that her son, who is part of her administration, was involved in organizing a $10 million US dollar loan for his wife's company. And they then invested that in a short-term property deal that yielded them millions of dollars of profit. And so, and Michelle Bachelet is trying to claim that she didn't know anything about it. You know, and so how seriously does should one take all that? And what one sees is, it's so, from my point of view, it's sadly amusing to see how the Chileans kind of stand on their dignity and say how dreadful it is that here us Chileans who have such a good record on corruption are faced with this series of scandals. And from my point of view, that's ridiculous.
Of course it is.
Because the Pinochet dictatorship was built on corruption.
Right.
Augusto Pinochet stashed millions of dollars in the top drawer Riggs Bank in where's the Riggs Bank based, in Washington or New York?
I don't know.
But that bank, the so-called, you know, it was regarded as an elite bank. It was just another dirty scam enabling foreign dignitaries and people in the United States to launder money.
And think of how stupid that is, too. You know, to the extent that Bachelet expresses any resistance to U.S. domination, they don't think that these people are aware of the fact that her son squirreled away a bunch of money in their bank.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's there as a weapon whenever they want to use it. I guess
yeah,
they sprung it.
And it's such a joke, isn't it, when politicians in these countries kind of try and stand on their dignity and at the same time they're so cynical in the way that they accept or at least tolerate and in many cases support the Western mainstream corporate media war on individuals like Nicolas Maduro or Daniel Ortega or, you know, any of those leading progressive politicians. It's very rare to get somebody like Michelle Bachelet, for example, making a public statement in solidarity with the leadership of the Bolivarian Revolution, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
So there's so much hypocrisy and cynicism involved, and it's very, very difficult to feel much sympathy for Michelle Bachelet, you know? Anyway, there's that going on, and here in the region, in Guatemala, in the Central American region, we've got a similar kind of crisis, where the Otto Perez, the Guatemalan president, is pretty much under siege,
yeah.
And his vice president has actually, I don't think she's actually been indicted, but and I think she's been called to give testimony in a corruption case involving her personal involvement in an alleged corruption ring involving the Guatemalan customs.
Okay.
So there's a very, very serious political crisis in Guatemala around that, with lots of people calling for the president to resign and so on. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. And here it's really interesting to see that you have in the United States this organization of the UNAC, the Anti-War Coalition.
Yes.
From my point of view, the three most important things that where people here in the region are hoping to happen is that the lifting of sanctions against Cuba. Another important issue is the getting the U.S. government and President Obama to withdraw their completely unjustified declaration of Venezuela as a threat to the security of the United States. And the third thing that's really important is to try and promote the support in the United States government and United States political circles for the peace process in Colombia, which is the kind of last holdover from the Cold War.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.